Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Fantastic beyond comprehension.
Gripping beyond compare.
Astounding beyond belief.
The mightiest monster of them all.
See Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
SOS, 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 welcome to the Tokyo SOS Podcast, live from Tokyo, or at least in our minds we're live from Tokyo. Sometimes it's better than being here, but we love America, yeah! Speaking of which, we're covering... I hate you so much, Jesse, I really do. Kinda ruin the mood, don't you?
I try.
But speaking of America, we are covering... an American movie! A Godzilla podcast covering an American movie? What might that be? Well, that is the, well, widely considered bomb that is the American Godzilla movie from 1998. But you're in for a shocker tonight because you're going to meet four people that actually enjoy it to it a bit. Yeah. Our cred is going to go so down after this. And the room is silent.
Well, I'll speak up. I don't know. Maybe we can present a good enough case to at least have people check it out again, maybe.
By the way, that was not Jesse's voice. That's because we have two special guests, but I'll get to them in a second. First, I got to introduce my partner in crime, my co-host, Jesse Garrett. Jesse, how are you doing tonight from the annals of Georgia?
Annals of... I don't think that works, man. But the annals of Georgia are good.
Speaking of the annals of Georgia, we have our good friend Scott H. Gardner.
Hey, how's it going?
From Tutu Freaks, because, you know, there was Bruce Springsteen, Madonna... way before Nirvana, there was YouTube Blondie, and music still on MTV. His two kids in high school think that he's uncool because he's still preoccupied with 1985. And that just flew over everybody's head.
Now, Jesse, where are you in Georgia?
Jackson.
Oh, okay.
Which is south of McDonough, north of Zeblin, I believe.
It's way on down there from where I am.
Is it the Jackson of the famous Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash Jackson song?
No, I think that's Jackson in Florida somewhere.
I was thinking Jackson.
Because that Jackson sounded like a fun town, let me tell you.
Well, I was thinking Jackson, Mississippi, so that shows what I know. But that that fourth voice is Chris Honeywell, who is Scott's co-host on many podcasts on the 22 Freak podcast.
Hello.
We also wanted to get Michael Bailey, but Michael Bailey actually has a podcasting career. And
screw that guy. He gets enough airtime.
Exactly. You know, how much more FaceTime does he need? He would just steal our thunder anyway, so.
Yeah, we
we'll say we wish he was here, but.
Yeah. Well,
you know what, true
he almost killed me he almost killed me last night when I was listening to the latest episode of Tales from the JSA. Because I have to learn not to be eating while Mike's saying things like, if anything from last issue, Power Girls howled out like a Thanksgiving turkey.
That's when you have to do those awful, like if you have to take nose drops or something.
Yeah.
That's that. You listen to that while you do that and you just pour them down your throat and go, and then all set. Yeah. Better than like a hot dog or something coming up your nose, you know.
And Jesse's so far behind, he has no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah,
But Jesse did look for emails in iTunes, and I believe we had two, right?
We did. They were regarding the April Fool's episode we did that apparently no one realized was an April Fool's episode.
Yeah. Let's preference is that we're these are somewhat negative, but we're not talking about these because, you know, we want to make fun of them or anything. We want to take the good with the bad, and so, like we said, you have an opinion, send it to us, we'll read it on the air. So, Jesse, you want to read those two?
Sure. Okay, we got one April 5th by Dense Clouds. It says, how are you going to call this episode Godzilla 2012 and then not talk about it at all? You'd rather talk about how Nala from Lion King turned on your friend. 2 stars.
I'm sorry.
And then April 10th, we got one from Darth Gorman. This one's a whopping 1 star. It says, seriously, these guys don't have a clue what they're talking about half the time. If they're going to do a podcast on Godzilla, they need to do some basic research, at the very least. Guys, Godzilla Final Wars was Godzilla's 50th anniversary film, not 60th. It's pronounced Gojira, not Gorgira. They also need to stay on topic better. On the Godzilla 2012 special episode, they do nothing but talk about animated movies and TV shows. Come on.
Now, I Well, I will accept that. I think if I go back, I said 60th. That was my mistake. And everybody makes mistakes sometimes. I'm sure Scott and Chris can
talk. Speak for yourself, man.
I gotta say, I thought all the mistakes in the show were made by you, Thomas.
Yeah. Well, I'm admitting to it right now. But yeah, I think I said 60th. And I meant to say 50th. I apologize for that. As for Gorgia, I do believe I've been pronouncing that right. Jesse could tell me if I've been pronouncing it wrong.
I haven't heard it pronounced wrong. I mean, yeah. From everything I've heard, it's right. But, you know, I'm American, not Japanese. And Southern.
Well,
does this email originate in Toho Studios or something? You know, you gotta
yeah, I doubt Darth Gorman is, I don't know.
I think everybody has their own way to pronounce these different things, because I've heard you guys pronounce the three-headed monster that I've always called Ghidra. Both you guys have a different pronunciation for that, and I'm just like, you know, that's cool. I mean, who cares how it's
we know what three.
Well,
yeah, we know.
There's actually three pronunciations, because there's Ghidorah, Ghidra, King Ghidra. There's like three different pronunciations for like the many times it's appeared. Because
right,
yeah, the one in Final Wars, you have the one in Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, All Out Monsters Attack.
It's like Princess Leia, Princess Leia. You know, I mean, they both work. Who cares? You know,
we know who they're
Han
talking
Solo,
about.
Han Solo, same thing. Mm-hmm.
Yep, ham salad. Yep,
exactly. But with comments on both those, I'm going to just take it that the April Fool's joke was a success. We've also...
I assumed, since we released it on April 1st, that people would assume that. But, yeah, apparently it worked.
I thought you guys were going to say you did, like, a live, you know, broadcast of, like, live from the Crystal Ballroom downtown, you know, and then Godzilla's coming over the horizon, and people were, like, slitting their wrists in their bathtubs and stuff.
And now, there's kids listening to this, as Scott can atone.
Oh, I didn't know that. Good. That's good. That's good to know with me and Mountain Dew.
I thought Scott already told you.
But it's okay. I can throw those walls up right away. I've got them all in place now. I've just put all those, like, you know, those guard lines you see at parades up already.
Yeah.
That was close too, because something's always bubbling at the surface.
We have listeners.
It's like 3 7-year-old kids.
Yeah. And I'm one of them.
Gotta be careful. Yeah.
So with that, we're going to get into the movie. Let's talk about, first I'm going to say credits before Jesse says the little synopsis he came up with, and so delightful. Written by Ronald Mitrin. Roland.
Come on, dude, they're Americans. You should be able to pronounce their names.
I've never heard of their names. Roland
Emmerich?
Emmerich, thank you. Roland Emmerich, Dean Devlin.
German.
Yeah, Dean Devlin are the writers. The screenplay was written by Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, who, for those who are actually pretty well-known screenplay writers, they wrote Aladdin. They also wrote Shrek and the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Hmm. I did not know that.
You have music by David Arnold, and I'll get to what he's done in a little bit. Starring Matthew Broderick, Maria Pitalello, which I'll be completely honest and show you how stupid I am. For the longest time, I actually thought it was Sarah Jessica Parker.
No, she's got nowhere near the horse face that Sarah Jessica Parker has.
Yeah, why the long face?
Wow.
Like, in my mind, up? I always imagined her, but yeah, she's nowhere near as...
She's got
the hair, though. It's that frizzy hair that I think...
Way to harp on Matthew Broderick's wife there. Jean...
Yeah, I know. He should dump her and hook up with this chick. It'd be a step up.
God,
dude, he's married to her?
Yeah.
Man.
You would think that Ferris Bueller could bag a better looking chick than her, that's for sure.
John Reno!
She's trying to... barriers up.
And to say the first part of our Simpsons connection, Hank Azaria. Produced by Dean Devlin and directed by Ronald Emmerich. I get...
Roland Emmerich.
I'm sorry. You look at that name and you want to see it 20,000 different ways, okay? Trust me, I practiced this all day and I still couldn't get it.
Now, see, it's hard.
The number one guy in Hollywood you go to when you want to blow stuff up is a German guy.
Right.
Or Michael Bay.
The White House. I got you. Okay.
I have a theory that he's getting even for World War II. I think that's what 2012, his last movie.
You either go to a German guy or you go to Michael Bay.
It's very hard for me to stay child friendly with those names banding about. And you throw a Bruckheimer in there and I'll start exploding.
You'll just Hulk out. Synopsis there, Jess.
Okay, I've got a pretty long-winded synopsis here, but I'm going to pause after every paragraph I have to actually read it ahead of time so I don't stutter.
Yay!
See, I came prepared this time.
We've moved up from a kindergarten reading level.
I'm at grade one now. Okay, the film opens with a montage of nuclear tests in the French Polynesia, where a nest of marine iguanas has been irradiated by the fallout.
And already Godzilla fans are pissed off.
Yeah, I know, it's like, ugh, Godzilla's not French. After the opening credits, a Japanese fishing ship is attacked and sunk by an unseen monster. There's only one survivor who, when questioned while recovering at a hospital, only replies, Godzilla. And that's pretty much all the Japanese have to do with the movie. Says, next we meet Dr. Nick Totopoulos, an NRC scientist who is researching the effects of nuclear testing on earthworms in Chernobyl. He is interrupted by the arrival of an agent from the U.S. State Department and sent to Panama to look at the wreckage of a downed Japanese ship. While there, he finds a set of massive footprints leading to the coast and also meets a mysterious Frenchman who introduces himself as Philippe Roche, an insurance agent.
Because insurance agents are just that quick.
And that French. He's just so awesome. Says, afterward, while studying a skin sample taken from the Japanese ship, Nick declares that the creature is a previously unknown animal and theorizes that nuclear testing may have mutated it into something unique. Godzilla, as the media incorrectly calls him, comes to Manhattan and wreaks havoc. The city is evacuated, and Nick proposes using a massive pile of fish to lure the creature into the open.
Because that's a lot of fish.
Yeah. Did you see the Doritos commercial recently?
You mean the one with the Super Bowl with the kid slapping?
No. The Godzilla.
Oh, yeah. Commercial.
Wasn't that, like, completely random?
I guess. I didn't go back and look at commercials. Maybe I should have.
Well, it came out, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I saw that one, too.
I don't
think someone didn't leave me hanging.
Oh, no, I know what you're talking about now. It just popped in, but it was with Doritos instead of fish.
Yeah, why did they decide to bring back the American Godzilla after, like, 5 years of no one caring?
They had it in the can or something, and they didn't use it or something. Who knows? It's weird, yeah.
Anyway, Godzilla takes the bait, but is scared off by the military, who gives chase. After destroying everything they throw at him, including Humvees and helicopter, Godzilla roars in victory atop the Chrysler Building.
Actually, just to correct you, it's the Empire State Building. They destroy the Chrysler Building. They destroy the Chrysler Building with a negative impact. That is a negative impact.
I know they have the Star Wars lines thrown in there.
Just impacted on the surface. They didn't use that line, but they might as well have.
Yeah.
Didn't go in. Just impacted on the surface.
But our DuPont torpedoes their ships are too small for our torpedoes to hit them. I got nothing. Move on!
After this, Nick collects a blood sample and discovers that Godzilla reproduces asexually.
See?
And is pregnant.
See, I'm not the only one that has a problem with the English language.
Damn conjectures. Okay, a reporter named Audrey Timmons, who happens to be Nick's old flame, steals the tape containing footage of the Japanese survivor and breaks the news of Godzilla's origin to the masses. And the military is outraged. Nick is thrown off the team and kidnapped by Felipe Roach, who reveals himself to be an agent of the French government who has been sent to cover up their role in the creature's creation. The military again attempts to defeat Godzilla, who dives into the Hudson River and destroys a couple of nuclear submarines. In the ensuing chaos, Godzilla is assumed dead. And here's where the movie turns into Jurassic Park. Nick and Felipe's team are joined by Audrey and her cameraman, Animal, where they discover hundreds of eggs in Madison Square Garden.
Now I'm pissed.
While the team... What?
No, Animal's line is, now I'm pissed, when he sees the destroyed Madison Square Garden.
Oh, yeah. Frank Azaria is awesome. While the team is planning explosions, the eggs begin to hatch, and smelling fish in the humans, assume them to be food. After losing several members of the team, Nick, Felipe, Animal, and Audrey take refuge in a TV broadcast booth. Once there, they contact the military, who orders an airstrike. The four escape short seconds before the whole thing blows up, and the poor baby Zillas are destroyed. Luckily they don't talk.
My father says I have to be courageous.
Could you imagine, like, 200 of those?
That would have made the movie actually more enjoyable.
I would have been into that, yeah.
Like 200 little smoke rings blowing out.
Yes.
As they approach Madison Square Garden, you see smoke rings rising from it, and they're like, "There's what could it be?" Could you imagine the Godzilla fans in the audience would be going berserk?
Like, what? Seconds later, Godzilla emerges from the wreckage, and being royally pissed off at the humans for destroying his babies, gives chase. They contact the military, who advise leading the creature to the Brooklyn Bridge. Godzilla becomes entangled in the suspension cables of the bridge and is finally taken down by the military. The crowd celebrates while Nick is obviously a little disheartened by the creature's demise. Felipe takes Animal's tape he recorded of the events and quietly leaves. The film ends with a shot of a lone egg having survived the explosion at Madison Square Garden, where it cracks open and begins to roar.
And sets up Godzilla the Animated Series.
Yeah, which would normally set up a sequel, but seeing as how it bombed, they decided just to make a cartoon instead.
Which a lot of people actually consider better than the movie.
I like the cartoon. It was
love it too.
I mean, I think this movie actually made money. I think it had the same perception as Star Trek the Motion Picture. Not that I'm going to say those two movies are on the same level, but...
Yeah, thank you for amending that statement, by the way.
I knew you were listening. And I just think it got a reputation as a bomb because it wasn't the humongous hit that they thought it was going to be. You know, it was like, oh, okay, we did all right, you know. And I think it made more money overseas than it did in America.
I think it did. Let me double check.
But I don't think they lost money on it.
Budget was $130 million U.S. Gross revenue worldwide was $379 million. $14,294.
So for that budget, that's pretty modest return, you know, for,
right.
Yeah,
for
it,
putting that
it says,
into it.
Godzilla was initially projected to take in $90 million in domestic sales. The actual four-day opening weekend sales was $55
million. Yeah, so half.
Godzilla took in $136,314,000. $136,314,294 at the domestic box office in America, and took $242,700,000 overseas.
That's why nobody spends that much money on That's why Godzilla movies are relatively low budget to other movies, I think. I think there's a certain amount of people who love Godzilla movies and go to them, but I don't think the masses. I think what they got on that Godzilla was very good for getting Joe, you know, who could care less about Godzilla more than maybe catching a couple of shows on TV when they were a kid. So I think they did pretty good in that respect, but I just don't think, and I think Roland Emmerich had some, you know, leverage after, you know, people after
Independence Day
that people were, you know, okay, we'll go see this movie. He blows up things real good.
Right. Well, I like Independence.
He'd had two big hits by that point. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, and the thing, and I know I've talked with this with Jesse before. It's a thing where I think with the '98 movie, a lot of people were just expecting a big monster mash. They weren't expecting sort of a sort of recreation of the original 1954 Japanese Godzilla movie.
Right.
Which, at that point, most Americans had not seen the actual original. They've only seen
the
American
Raymond
version.
Burr.
Yeah, with Raymond Burr.
Style. Yeah.
So they weren't used to that. And I think that's going to change with the 2012 movie that's coming out. And the fact that now a lot of people have seen the actual original 1954 Godzilla movie. And people will be probably expecting more of a sort of remake than a monster mash. Which I think is good for the series because it sets up, I think, more American Godzilla movies afterwards. Preferably a Godzilla vs. King Kong remake, which we all want.
Yeah. Well, I gotta tell you, I was insanely psyched for this movie. Because I was sort of like, you know, at that point, the whole CG thing was relatively new. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to see what an American take on Godzilla will be like in New York City getting smashed up. Yeah, I can deal with that. I can't remember what movie he came out with between Independence Day and Godzilla, but I'd liked Independence Day.
I think this was the next one after Independence Day.
Yeah.
The first one he had done was Stargate, which was
Stargate. Which I still have to this day have not seen.
Don't waste your time, it's terrible.
I remember getting dragged to Independence Day and going, well, that wasn't as bad. That was entertaining, you know. That it worked on some entertainment level, and that so I was so psyched for Godzilla, and all my friends were so psyched that our band called up the local theater chain and said, "We'll bring our band in and set up there, and play Blue Oyster Cult Godzilla all night
yes.
in the lobby, nonstop." If we can go to the midnight show free. And they said, okay. So we did that. And then we got to go into the midnight show. And I remember, I was so wound up to see it. And I was also tired after lugging equipment and stuff. And it was a midnight show. And the movie's 2 hours long, you know, or 2 hours plus. And I remember it was wearing me down towards the end. And I remember, you know, not being like, oh, I didn't like that movie. But upon watching it again, I enjoyed it a lot more, I think, than just recently watching it again.
And again, go ahead.
I do have some beefs with it.
Well, again, and as we'll get into when we get into Rich, we'll talk about some of the things I think that that were the fundamental flaws. Scott, what were your initial views?
I have a nasty feeling I'm the only one in this room that really loves this movie. I remember when it came out, and I really didn't have any interest in it because, I'm kind of the guy I think Chris was talking about. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember Godzilla movies being
on. I was too.
And I'd watch a little bit of them and everything, but I wasn't really into them. To me, they were like cartoon. You know, they were like Saturday morning cartoons. You know, you watched them for a little while, and then you got bored, and you went off and played with your Star Wars figures or something. So, I've seen a lot of them, but I've seen a lot of them in pieces. You know, and I couldn't quote you scenes or even tell you what happened in what movie or what. But I know I've seen a lot of bits and pieces of all the different ones. But you know, so I wasn't like really. I didn't have any like firm attachment to Godzilla, and I definitely didn't go in with any, you know.
Scott and I were more War of the Gargantuas guys in high school.
Yes.
Love that movie.
Love
War
that.
War of the Gargantuas is awesome.
That is an awesome movie. I wish
used to watch
that
we
Jesse
just
has
lucky
it.
Enough to catch
it, yeah.
Once when we were on TV. Oh, I've since downloaded it. It's got the one of the most awesome songs in the world, which is the words get stuck in my throat.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Love that song.
With like the biggest pun ever, because she actually gets stuck in his throat.
Exactly, at the end of it. And he doesn't he like eat her and like spit out her dress?
Yeah,
afterwards?
Yeah,
like,
spit out
it's
her
all
dress.
Clean and it just floats down. It's just like, hey, that's a nice trick there, Gargantua. Scott and I just caught that movie one day and once we saw those scenes where they would just go jogging through the city, just sort of running.
Slow motion or something. Yeah, it was awesome.
Just like, what is going on here? This is awesome. Hilarious. And
I know as a kid, it was a lot easier to reenact that movie with your buddies because they're kind of shaped. So you're just like, all right, I'm going to be Green Gargantua. I'm going to throw you over the building here. I don't want to be thrown over the building. You'll be thrown over the building.
So, Jesse, what were your initial views from watching the... Oh, wait a minute, Scott, did you finish your...
Oh, no, I was just getting into it, actually. I was just going to say, I mean, I remember when this came out, and I kind of considered going to it just because, you know, I had seen his other movies, and I didn't think much of Independence Day, but I thought the special effects were awesome. I'm a sucker for seeing stuff just blow up in movies, so I figured if nothing else, he'll have a lot of stuff blowing up. That'll be cool. But I waited to hear stuff about it, and then every review I heard and every person I knew that saw it, they all hated it. They all said how terrible it was and everything. So I was like, well, you know, that'll save me $8. I won't go see it. And then years later, I caught it on DVD and loved it. And it's one of those movies, you know, it's another in a long line of movies that I really, really enjoy and just look at it and go, I don't get it. What does everybody hate about this movie? I think it's cool. So... That's my story.
I can tell you some negatives, but I don't think anybody. It doesn't sound like anybody here actually hates it, which I think makes us all the minority, but makes you like a super minority.
Well, I mean, there's definitely things about it that you know that I've got a problem with it because it's another one of those movies where I don't think it's as bad at it as like the Jurassic Park movies are, but it's another one of those movies that wants to give you a bunch of stupid stories of all the people involved in the movie, and I don't want to see that. I want to see a big monster eating
smashy,
people,
smashy,
smashing stuff, knocking buildings over, stuff blowing up. Bodies flying, people getting ripped in half. That's what I want to see.
And you
and
get
if
it.
If they did that for 2 hours, I'd be like, yes. But
well,
instead,
you get it
they
in
want
spades
to give you
for
Matthew
the first
Broderick's
hour.
Girlfriend, and she's trying so hard to be a real reporter. And it's like, I don't care about any
she
of these
betrays
people.
Betrays him
they
and
get eaten. You
they
know,
have backstory.
I hope they all get eaten.
Well, let's wait because we'll get into that because that actually deals with a talking point we have.
Okay.
Well, let's get to Jess so we can then finally move on. To music.
I do agree with Scott. That's one of the reasons I'm the like one of the only people who liked Jurassic Park 3 because it had just dinosaur on dinosaur action.
Yes,
like, right
I like that movie too.
Wow, I didn't
like,
know
yes.
it swung that way.
Yeah, it's like T-Rex and the dinosaur fighting. That's
hot and sweaty dinosaur on dinosaur action.
Next time from Vivid Videos.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I saw it. I think I saw it for my birthday or around there when it came out, and I liked it, and I still like it to this day. I view it from two different perspectives as a fan of the Godzilla series as a whole, and then as like a casual kind of movie fan, or just holding the film on its own without trying to judge it by any of the other standards. But I'd enjoy it. It is a popcorn movie. You know, you just kind of sit back, ignore the plot, and just watch everything happen. I think all the Emmerich's movies are.
Yeah, and I think that's how you have to watch it, is a popcorn flick. But let's just start.
A lot of the negative feedback it got is people judging it, you know, from the old ones. And even people who aren't fans of the Godzilla, they hear people who are, and it's like, oh, well, they're saying it sucks, so I might, you know, I might agree with it.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
I kind of feel it has the same. They were kind of trying to go for the same thing that they went with the new Star Trek movie, trying to make it cool and hip. It's like the original Godzilla doesn't matter now. This is how you want to do it.
Right.
So that kind of, I hope they don't do that with the new one, but that's how I kind of feel they went with the marketing and everything. Size does matter, and you know, it's like the Americanized version.
Well, and that's one of the things. We'll talk about it now. It's the thing that there was so much hype behind this movie. There was so much advertising behind this movie that it was hard for the movie to live up to its expectations.
Yeah, I think they hyped it all up to... I think they didn't have to hype it up. I think the people who wanted to see that movie would go see that movie. And, you know, that probably was another reason it didn't make as much money, as they had to spend so much on promotion and toys. Oh, God, the Godzilla toys everywhere that were...
Hey, I like the Godzilla toys.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, it was because of this movie coming up that we got, I think, was one of the bigger... That and the movies that were being made in the 90s from Toho, that you had that Godzilla line.
Well, they clogged the toy aisles for a long time because they just didn't sell as many as they thought they were going to sell. So you
not just the American, but also the Japanese line, where you had Space Godzilla, which is sitting.
Dude, those toys are awesome.
Yeah, which is sitting above my computer right now, and the armored Godzilla.
Best.
I still have pieces of it. It's broken, but it's like in my closet. Don't feel too sad there, Jess.
It's funny, I'm just realizing a hypocrisy of myself about Roland Emmerich, as I did a rant podcast a while ago about how I just hated, and here's where I'm really stopping myself from using adult language. I just hated the guy. I had watched 2012 and just, it's like, this guy, you know, there's no story, and I'm griping about there being no story, but in Godzilla... there's too much story. So I guess he can't, I guess either whether he's doing too much story or too little story or whatever, his story element of his movies is always just...
But that's not his strong suit.
No, it's definitely not his strong suit. His strong suit obviously is people running away from something chasing him. That's his...
yeah.
And things blowing up. Yeah, it's special effects.
And for the first hour of Godzilla, that's what it is.
Yeah,
and then it bogs down. You see, the thing that I didn't like the most was the as you mentioned in your synopsis, when it turned to Jurassic Park for a little while.
Yeah, even as a kid when I saw it, that took me out of the movie. I was like,
right,
hey, I'm watching Raptors now.
Okay,
yeah, and that was what really bothered me, because it was just like, I want to see Godzilla. Godzilla Spawn is good. I'd like to see that as maybe a 5 or 10 minute side note or something, but not a whole, you know, yeah, it was evading raptors. It looked just like a sort of third rate Jurassic Park.
It really felt like they were trying to cash in on the whole Lost World came out a year before, I believe.
But with that being said, let's hold up, because that's again one of the talking points. We want to have something to talk about later. let's go on to our usual jib jab. We'll start off with music. Let's talk about the score of the movie done by David Arnold. So just to let you guys know some of the movies he did, here's his the stuff he's done: The Young American, Stargate, The Last of the Dogmen, Independence Day, A Life Less Ordinary, Tomorrow Never Dies. He did 98 Godzilla, The World Is Not Enough, Shaft, Baby Boy, The Musketeer, Zoolander, Changing Lanes, Enough, Die Another Day, Too Fast, Too Furious, The Stepford Wives, Little Britain, Four Brothers, Stoned, Amazing Grace, Casino Royale, Hot Fuzz, Grindhouse, Agent Crush, Quantum of Solace, Crooked House, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of Dawn Treader, and Morning Glory, which are those last two are two that are in production. So he's done a lot of
music. He's all over the place.
He's done a lot of music for a lot of shows. He did the 90s Bond and has been still doing the Bond movies.
Yeah, I skipped the Pierce Brosnan Bonds are the only Bond movies I haven't ever seen, but I came back for the Daniel Craig, and his scores for the two Daniel Craigs are phenomenal. But for me personally, this is one of the things that I'm sorry.
What was that, Jesse?
He said GoldenEye's the only one you need to see if the 90s Bond.
Oh, okay. I might have to check that one out.
I enjoyed that one. That's like bleh.
For me, I mean, this is one of the big things that won me over for this movie was David Arnold's score. I think he did a phenomenal job, and I really, really enjoy his score for this movie a lot, especially the opening scene where we're seeing the detonations of the bombs. That's awesome.
I think that's the first score that initially jumps out to you, and how good that score is. And I think the great thing about that score is that it really sets up the mystery. And as we'll be talking about a little later, we're going to be talking about the similarities, at least with the 1954 original Godzilla movie. And with this, I mean, it's done American style in the sense that you use music as opposed to sort of the silence that the Japanese use in their movies. But here, you know, using sort of the American film style, using music, the mood was set perfectly for the mystery that's going to be in the first half of the movie. With the opening score.
I would agree with that.
And
my only comment is that the score in the first half of the movie is really good, but then after that, pretty much after once Godzilla's revealed, I can't tell you much of it. It's kind of telegraphed after that. It's like once that mystery's gone, the score kind of took the back seat, obviously to the graphics. But
it's a lot of chase music.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like kind of like repeats the same thing.
And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that you are so focused on the action happening on screen that you maybe can't pay attention to the music that's on screen. But the one that I did notice was sort of the theme, sort of what was, I guess you can call it the Nick and Audrey theme, mm-hmm. that little love theme that they had. I thought that was very nice, too.
There's really only, I think that may be why, you know, what you're talking about with the music kind of getting lost in the second half of the movie. It's funny you say that because I was listening to the extended version of the soundtrack, the two album version. And I usually only listen to just the first album because I find the second one is kind of just backgroundish, but the first one works very well. And it's because it works the three themes that are really with the movie, which is, you know, the big monster theme, which pretty much brings the movie in. It's like the main theme of the movie starting out. And then you've got the
military theme.
You can almost call it like the love theme, where it's like in the moment where Matthew Broderick sees Godzilla for the first time, it's almost like a love theme between those two characters, between, you know, the monster and Matthew Broderick. And then there's the love theme between Matthew Broderick and his ex-girlfriend, and that's pretty much the three themes that are in the movie. But they play a lot of it in the first half of the soundtrack, and then after that it's just a lot of running and chasing music, and it does become just generic action, you know, music in the second half of the movie.
Well, you know, and with that first theme, you know, it's actually more of a combination of a monster theme and a military theme for those of us who've heard Akira's scores on the original Godzilla. You know, when you first hear that theme at the first part of the beginning of the movie, you get a lot of sort of snare drum in the background, da 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 da, and da 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 da, and then you hear the explosion happens, and that's when it goes into sort of the monster part of it, da 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 da. And it kicks up that notch, and that's sort of the monster theme part of it. And I think that's why it works so well, is it sort of combines those two type of themes so well.
Absolutely.
Well, I think he definitely had the original Godzilla music in mind when this was done. You know, it definitely pushed a lot of the same buttons. And, and I think he also pulled off, you know, not just aping it. You know, he didn't just, you know, just copy it and leave it at that. He just took the essence of it, and there was definitely a lot of a thought put into the execution of this movie, which is, it hurts me to say about Roland Emmerich.
But, you know, let's talk about something that the original 1954 Godzilla didn't have, and that's a soundtrack, as in songs that were inspired by the movie. Yeah. Not the type of song, but you had to... Well,
Are you talking about Puff Daddy?
Yeah.
Well, I like that song.
Yeah. It's pleasing to the ear, but it really... Why didn't they do that with Blue Oyster Cult Godzilla? Maybe there was some copyright thing or Blue Oyster Cult didn't want to do it or something, but... I mean, that would have been the natural,
yeah.
I would think, to remix instead of Kashmir. But I love Kashmir. I love hearing it all cut up. I hate rap songs that start out with someone going, yeah, uh-huh, yeah. That always drives me nuts. But, you know, I mean, at that time, every movie ended with a rap remix of something, you know, the movie would end and then you would hear a break beat come in and somebody
every time
rapping.
I hear one of those, it reminds me, I don't know if you ever heard there was an album back late 80s early 90s, I think it was called Simply Mad About the Mouse, and it was all the pop stars of the day doing Disney covers. And one of them was LL Cool J doing The Three Little Pigs, and he's doing exactly what you're saying, Chris, through the whole thing. The background singers are going, three little pigs, three little piggywigs. And he's going, through the whole thing. And I'm like, he's getting paid for this? So, every time I hear something like that, it reminds me of
the best LL Cool J song from a movie is the one from Deep Blue Sea.
I hate you so much. I really do.
I mean, he has such lyrical masterpieces as... Deep ass, blue ass, my hat is like a shark's fin.
I hate you so much. I really do. All you good hell. But, you know, you didn't just have Puff Daddy. You also had Rage Against the Machine. I love that song that they did, No Shelter Here.
Yeah, it's once again, I like that band, too. And not out of play. I mean, they put the Puff Daddy song or P. Diddy song, if you want to be up to date. So like somebody had it on a boombox in the subway once, so they could actually say it was in the movie. I know how Scott feels about rock songs tacked on. You know, when you get right down to it, they're put on to sell CDs to the public. You know,
yeah.
And at that time, every movie had, you knew you were either going to get a rap song at the end of it, or you were going to get, I don't remember the name of the band, but the band who did Hey Now You're a Rock Star.
Smash Mouth?
No.
Yeah, you knew you were going to get that at the end of almost every movie in that one period in the late 90s, you know?
Step off Mystery Men, okay? You well, step off that right now, sir.
Well, I think they were the first ones to use it, but then it turned up just 8 zillion times. The first one that just springs to mind was that Rat Race with an actual live performance by the band and all the characters in the movie, like, on stage. And it just got to, I think Smash Mouth just over licensed that song or something. I love Mystery Men. That's a great movie. But, you know, I mean, I think those songs, you know, they were, let's face it, they're there to, you know, most people don't want to hear soundtrack music. They want to get the exclusive. They want to hear like Journey on the Tron soundtrack.
Well, you know, and you, I mean,
you're
y'all...
just trying to push my buttons, aren't you?
Now, Scott, remember your child is listening.
It's not me. It's the Mount Dew.
How is that this different from any other podcast you do with Scott?
Yeah.
But no, and you had Wallflowers doing Hero, which I thought was a very good song. And the one-hit wonder that was whatever the hell that name is, singing that song. That was like the fourth song on the soundtrack. I'm Going Deeper Underground.
I'm not familiar with that one. The last one, I've heard that song before.
I'm Going Deeper Underground. Damn. It was like white rap. Which is probably why it's forgettable.
I'm only familiar with the score. I've never tortured myself by listening to the songs inspired by album.
Let's move on to special effects. Let's actually talk about Godzilla himself. This was obviously a CG version compared to the Japanese studio suit. So let's talk about the design of Godzilla and how the CG worked. I was watching this the other day, and of course, being that we are 10 years, or should I say 12 years removed from it, and yeah, CG technology has gotten better, it does start to look a little dated. But overall, it looks very, very good. And me personally, I thought it was very creative for it to be a very slim Godzilla design instead of a more bulky, as the suit Godzillas are. And I think it really then was influenced by the fact that this Godzilla was a very intelligent monster.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I put it in my notes as the King Kong scene, where Godzilla comes upon the second pile of fish and checks it out, checks out the cops, checks out the fish, and has a little brain cell rubbed together. It goes, no, this is a trap, and
right.
And stands on the edge of the trap looking at it. And there's just a sort of face off where there is a little bit of because for the most part with Godzilla, there's usually not any kind of person to Godzilla interplay. It's like shoot at Godzilla. Godzilla destroys things and knocks down things that are shooting at him, just sort of reptile brain stuff. And this one had a couple scenes where, Godzilla might be, although they had, every once in a while a kid could talk to Godzilla or something like that. But, they gave him a little more. I think not that there's any kind of physical probability or way that you could make a giant reptile like that gravity would support and et cetera, et cetera. But I think they made him look a little more physically viable as a mutated
marine iguana.
Yeah, so he moved a little more like an iguana, just like the new King Kong moved more like a real ape than sort of an animated thing. He was more like off the movements of a real gorilla, and I think that worked for that. I was kind of that was some of the stuff that I kind of liked about the movie, although they did have big issues with scale with Godzilla, because sometimes he was really huge. And other times he was just, T-Rex huge, Yeah. Sometimes he was dwarfing buildings, and other times he was, by the end he had to be smaller, because when he chased a taxi cab, if it was the Godzilla that the helicopters were chasing, he would have just had to take two steps and snap up that taxi cab. There wouldn't have been any way a car could outrun him, He was outrunning helicopters going full bore, so they had to change the scale, and that doesn't really bother me because I'm not going to this movie to be convinced of its reality. I want to see things get smashed. When New York City starts getting smashed up, I was in my glory in that movie. I was just like, yes, yes. Oh my God, it's collapsing. That's just what it should do. That's a landmark. Yes. Goodbye. I love it. That's what you want. That's the bang for your buck. That's the sizzle for your steak with Godzilla movies, And so the first hour is like sizzling like crazy. And then he put it on the back burner for a little while. It was weird. But when it's sizzling, boy, it's smashy, smashy. People get, what I wonder is, though, he uses his fire breath twice, and nobody mentions it or reacts to it. Matthew Broderick, the scientist.
Would go, it's power breath to be actually. If what I'm guessing right, it's the fact that, because he can hold his breath underwater for so long, that it's basically power breath. He's just breathing out
and then it ignites.
Yeah, and because it picks up the cars because of the heat of it and whatnot. It ignites the fuel tanks and then it becomes fire. It's not atomic breath like the sort of class.
Right. Yeah, very ambiguous.
Yeah, which we'll get to that.
Twice, sort of low key. Yeah.
We'll get to that at a little later. Scott, your views on the CG Godzilla, or at least the just design and compared to the suit Godzilla.
See, at the risk of you ending the call right now, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say thank God they didn't make him look like the old version. You know, that they didn't do a man in a rubber suit, or that they didn't do a CGI version of a man in a rubber suit. Because
and this is the last time you'll hear Scott Carter on his podcast.
Well, Godzilla looked like that because you had to fit a man in the suit. That's why they had to make him like that.
Right.
You know,
right.
So they
Since this movie has come out, there have been new Godzilla movies, and they've gone right back to the old formula again. And I just look at that and scratch my head and go, wow, you know, did you guys really just not learn anything? You know, because I think those days of that kind of movie making are over. You know, people want to see something that, granted, you know, going into any movie, there's that suspension of disbelief. But one of the things I like about this one is that it took some of it took the basic premise. I like that it's not slavish to the original Tokyo stuff. I actually like that a lot. I like that they took the idea of Godzilla and they wanted to Americanize it, and they wanted to make it more of a true monster movie rather than a silly guy in a rubber suit. And that's what works so well for me in this movie. I realize that it doesn't obviously work for other people because the movie didn't, you know, do all that great, but that's what I like about it.
Well, I think it would have done worse if it was a guy in a rubber suit, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Well, for what they wanted to do, but, you know, and I think the thing is that it compares to, and I know you're maybe talking about some, I don't know which recent movies you're talking about, whether Godzilla 2000 or Final Wars or whatever, but I know, and me and Jess can talk about from experience that a lot of times what it really has to deal with is it has to deal with camera perspective and how the camera is used. And when you watch the original 1954 Godzilla, it really is hard to tell that that's a guy in the suit.
Yeah, that movie was approached very seriously.
Yeah,
you know, and as Godzilla went on and the budgets went down and it became
more
like,
for children, which is really the thing about it is when you look at a lot of the 70s stuff, it is a lot more for children. And so it looked a lot more human, it acts more human. And for that sense, and I think that's why that's the initial view that people have of Godzilla is that's sort of the classic Godzilla now. And because of that, yeah, it's, a guy in a suit. Yeah, it's obvious. I'm like, yeah, it's obvious when they've been using the same suit for the past 20 years. And you can see the zipper and the tails falling off.
Yeah, but I think I think to address what Scott said about why didn't they use CG in the newer Godzillas is, I'll bet you they didn't have the budget to do it. It's still, America, we have the infrastructure for CG. We have big, you know, production houses. I mean, the first...
Well, model making in America has gotten really expensive as opposed to Japan. Yeah. I think that's what you're trying to harp on, and which is very much true. Even though both are now expensive, CG is relatively less expensive than building models, blowing up, and having to build the models over and over again, which costs a lot of money. And so I think it's unfortunate, personally, that type of filmmaking is gone, not because it's out of date, but because basically nobody wants to pay the money.
Well, I mean, personally, I've been thinking, as I get older and I look at movies with cheesy special effects and stuff like that, I start to think of them, you know, I start really, like, not thinking it might be a good thing. It might just be a trend that'll wear off or a phase of having everything be completely realistic. Sometimes it's like watching a play, you know?
Yeah.
Where you have actors in costumes, where you know they're in costumes, so... It's, you know, I mean, to watch a Godzilla movie, there's so many levels of, especially, you know, depending on whether you see it on a TV screen or in a movie theater. In a movie theater, you're watching it with a bunch of people. So sometimes watching cheesy special effects with a bunch of people is a lot of fun. At home, you could be with your friends drinking beer or whatever. So sometimes those cheesy special effects bring you into a mindset for a movie and, you know, and the cheesier the special effects in Godzilla movies, usually the cheesier the content in them too. And,
yeah.
But like you said about the original one was, you know, they really worked hard to make it look realistic.
Yeah.
And
not to want to cut you off, but I want to get to Jess because Jess, we haven't heard a lot from Jess tonight.
because you got Scott and I on, and yeah. I'm drinking the dew.
The dew. No, yeah, I honestly believe that with CG and with everything ultra-realistic as it is, it kind of takes the imagination out of movies because that suspension of disbelief is not there as much. And now people are kind of, especially younger kids, are kind of almost spoiled in that they don't have to try as hard to enjoy a movie or watch it.
Yeah.
They expect everything to be photorealistic, and you know, they can't enjoy a movie.
Yeah, exactly. Or there's lots of kids who just don't do like black and white. I don't watch black and white.
Let's move on. Let's talk about the CG city of New York. We already sort of started talking about models, but let's talk about, you know, the CG city of New York with the models of Tokyo. Let's compare them. Chris?
I liked it. I liked that they kept it dark. You know, a lot of it happened in the dark at nighttime, and it was weird because from the perspective of Chasing Godzilla, all of a sudden it made New York City something that you don't usually, you usually see it from the ground up, and here you were seeing it like a giant maze.
Yeah. And, which it very much is to an extent.
Yeah, yeah, especially if you're talking, if you're on Godzilla's scale.
Or you're talking Spider-Man even. I know from, like, just play like Spider-Man 2 or Ultimate Spider-Man for the PS2.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Xbox, but PS2, and you sort of get that same type of feeling. So definitely a maze. I think the best part for me CG-wise was, I hate to say this, but the destruction of the Chrysler Building.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Well, it was good because it was a great moment where you see him curve around Godzilla and you see the reaction of the pilot as he knows he just destroyed, he's the guy who just destroyed the Chrysler Building, and he has to, you know, that was a negative impact, and then, you know, it starts sinking in into the, you know, and you got
Mike,
Siskel and Ebert starting to realize what's going on, you know.
Mary Ebert and his
Gene cousin. Something. His name is Gene, though.
Yeah, but it was a knock. It was supposed to be sort of a knock at Siskel and Ebert because they gave Independence Day a bad review.
And I looked before we did this show. I was searching all over the place to see if I could find the clip where Siskel and Ebert reviewed this movie to see if they addressed that they were in it.
They did.
Obviously in it, but I couldn't find it. I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Yeah, they did it. Although Robert Ebert was somewhat amused by the parody, he gave Godzilla an overwhelming negative review, stating, "They let us off lightly. I fully expect to be squished like a bug by Godzilla. Now that I've inspired a character in a Godzilla movie, all I really still desire is for several Ingmar Bergman characters to sit in a circle and read my review to one another in a hushed tone."
I love Roger Ebert.
So Scott, what did you think of the CG City?
Oh, I thought it was pretty cool. I think it's, off the top of my head, it's the best one I can think of, short of like the recent King Kong remake, you know, where they meticulously went in and tried to recapture that period feel. That was just beautiful. But yeah, I thought this was very well. And again, I mean, how could you not make it better with modern effects? Because, you know, to my recollection, in the old, you know, Godzilla movies, you know, the Tokyo Studios ones, they were just, you know, they were boxes. You know, he'd step on a building and there were no floors, there was no furniture, there were no people or even little action figure size stuff inside.
Dolls,
it was just like an empty box, and it was, you know, those were fun for its time, but now you had to, you know, you had to play to a modern audience that was going to expect that if, you know, a building got, you know, knocked open or knocked over or something, that they were going to see real things inside. And in a lot of instances you did. I thought that was pretty cool.
Jesse?
I think it was good. I like the fact that it was at night helped the CG a lot.
Yep.
Because you look at the movie and you're like, just like Jurassic Park, most of the stuff's at night. It holds up really well as opposed to some other movies that came out around the same time. And the nighttime really made it look a lot better.
Okay.
And I do agree that, you know, when buildings got smashed, there were stuff in it, which is a nice change. I still prefer the models just because they have more weight to them, and that's a problem with a lot of CG. Is it just doesn't have that kind of gravity to it? But I think it I think on the whole it was good. I really liked the scene when he was in underwater, so that was pretty cool because that's something you didn't see Godzilla do yet.
Yeah.
Yes, and he did it like a lizard would. You know, it had a very lizard like feel. It was
You see Godzilla underwater. You saw Godzilla fight the sea monster underwater, Jess.
Well, you didn't see him swimming though. You just saw him. You saw him just kind of walking underwater. This is the first time you really saw him swimming like a lizard.
That, I remember now that was when I saw the movie on the big screen. That was one of the parts where everybody was like, "Oh, that's really cool," because he tucks down and tucks his tail in and puts his arms in, just like sort of more, not as much like an iguana, but almost like a crocodile would swim. Or an alligator.
And you know, and speaking speaking of that, they're thinking it now. It's obviously influenced Toho because they had Godzilla do that. I think it was Godzilla versus Megaguirus, which came out, I think, 3 years, or excuse me, 3-4 years later, or the one, or God Tokyo SOS. I can't remember which, but there's Megaguirus. Where he's swimming underwater, and it's very like what it is in the night.
It's the same thing. He kind of tucks his tail in and uses it as like a rudder.
Yeah.
Talked about the parallels between this and Jurassic Park. Well, in the novel, you know, the original novel of Jurassic Park, the T-Rexes do that. They swim underwater very much like an alligator, but the CG technology just wasn't there when Spielberg made Jurassic Park. And this movie kind of one-upped Jurassic Park by being able to actually show that and have their creature do that. And I thought that was cool. That was something I was very impressed with. Was up to that point, we hadn't seen CG underwater before. I don't, you know, not to that detail anyway, for like a monster. We'd seen it like with Hunt for Red October and stuff where it was something you expect to see underwater.
Right, and it was something solid and static that it wasn't moving and living, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is, especially underwater, because it took place at night, again, I think it helped the CG immensely instead of having to be with water and all the type of effects that need to be added because of that. But the second thing is, it sort of copies Jurassic Park, but I'm like, well, you know what? The Tyrannosaurus and Godzilla, they're sort of the same type of look as far as how slim they are. So I would imagine they would both move the same way. So I don't think it's fair to sort of harp on Godzilla for copying Jurassic Park just because it came a year before it.
Well, I think the baby Godzillas were the part that seemed like Jurassic Park.
The most.
They were like raptors that looked like T-Rexes.
Especially with the baby T-Rex from Lost World. But I think the biggest... I did hear a few people talk about, you know, they made Godzilla look like a giant T-Rex. I think that's just the only kind of logical design you can do for a giant iguana, basically.
Yeah.
Without having him drag his tail around. Because that's the only bad thing I'll say about Godzilla's original design is that he drags his tail. And it's kind of, you know, not very...
Well, in the original, it dragged the tail, but as it got to later movies and they got better with wider effects, you know, it would...
Be wired up there, yeah, a little bit, yeah. But you would see it would even bounce a little bit sometimes on the wire.
Yeah. To finish off with special effects, let's talk about other effects. Let's talk about, you know, sort of the gunfire, the explosion, the tanks, the submarines, the ships with the gaping holes in them.
Well, my favorite special effects sequence, there's really two special effects I like best in this. One of them is really subtle, and that's where we see the long pan down the street, and we see the Pan Am building with a giant hole through it. You know, that's such a subtle special effect, but it is a special effect, and I think it looks really cool because it's very believable looking. And then I like the entire sequence where the monster comes up for the first time, eats the fish, and has the little moment with Matthew Broderick, and then the big gun battle starts.
Yeah.
And I actually liked the destruction of the Flatiron building a lot better than I liked the destruction of the Chrysler building. I think that looks really cool because that that building's got, you know, such history. Not that the Chrysler building doesn't, but the other one really
does.
And especially if you're a Spider-Man fan, you know, you look at that and go, oh, they just blew up the Daily Bugle, you know, so I really like that. But I think the special effects are phenomenal in this, especially the CG. I think it holds up well. I think the only stuff in this that is starting to look a little rough around the edges is some of the composite shots, because they're still doing that
little bit of matte line and stuff.
Matte lines, yeah. But they could easily go back in and, you know, do a George Lucas and fix that stuff these days too.
Yeah, Chris,
I like the
I'm trying to think of what my favorite special effects sequence is, where they're in the office building, and I can't. Is she talking to her? She's talking to
her mother,
Principal Skinner, her mother, and Godzilla goes walking by the building.
And there's Barney playing in the TV.
Who is that woman, by the way? She looks familiar. I think she might have been the little girl on Family Affair, but I'm not positive. Does anybody know who that woman is?
No.
She's famous from something, but I just can't figure out where I know her from.
I can attempt to look, so Chris, stall for me.
but that sequence was I thought that sequence was a really neat reveal of the scale of Godzilla. And then after he walked by, there was just a beautiful shot out the window of his tail wagging behind him. And it looks for all the world like it's going to come through the window and just smash out the window. And with Roland Emmerich, you're expecting that. But no, it just sort of just misses it and keeps going down. And, you know, they're left in silence with the guy like, whoa, what are you looking at? You know, sort of thing.
All right. Wait a minute. Scott, were you talking about Kamen's secretary? The one who was on
I guess that's who she is, yeah.
Because it is Nancy Cartwright. Or at least that's what it has listed on IMBD.
That's Marge Simpson, right?
Yeah, that's Marge Simpson.
Huh. I thought that name sounded familiar.
Yeah, she. Well, it continues the Simpsons.
Yeah. Yeah. There's three Simpsons in there, yeah. That's right.
Hank Azaria
and Principal Skinner.
Yeah. That's
Harry Shearer.
But we'll get to that in a second. I wanted to leave that for acting. So continue with continue on, Chris.
I just loved that scene. I loved it in the movie theater. And there was a little bit of matte line in that, but it reminded me of old King Kong and Godzilla movies, and it had the modern twist in it. And I just thought it was a honest moment of a special effect, making me, you know, I was preparing for the reaction of his tail coming through the window, and it didn't happen. So that scene, like, definitely it plays the audience like a fiddle, and I hate that it's Roland Emmerich that did it, but I will acknowledge that he did. But I think the rest of his cinematic career will back up my opinion of him. But that, I liked all the smashing, and I think that it all worked out. But that was a scene that really, you know, that it was almost a Spielberg moment. You know, it almost reminded me of the old days when you would see a Spielberg movie, and there would be something really cool would happen on the screen, and you'd actually hear the whole audience go, "Whoa!"
Jess, so,
and that rarely happens anymore.
Unfortunately. Yeah. My two favorite scenes or special effects were the whole helicopter fight scene or chase scene. I thought was phenomenal, with him kind of ducking and weaving through the, looks like a maze pretty much. And like you were saying earlier, when he ducks out the way and the guy shoots the building, it's just like, oh, that is awesome. But that scene, and then when they're in the tunnels and they run into what they think is, I guess, like a dead end, but it turns out it's Godzilla, and he slowly moves out the way. It's like, oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a second.
We will return to Tokyo SOS after these short messages.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
I'm Batman.
This looks like a job for Superman.
Monthly Mondays, available the third Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
They are the first and best team of mystery men ever to assemble for the cause of justice. The heroes that have been part of their ranks are legendary. They fight for America and for democracy, and yet no one has devoted a podcast to their exploits. Until now. Unfortunately, it's hosted by these guys.
I don't care what Julius Schwartz says. Yeah, League sounds like a baseball team. I hate baseball. So, there you go. First F-bomb of the show.
How did you beat me to the first F-bomb of the show?
Scott Gardner and Michael Bailey present Tales of the Justice Society of America. Fridays at Two True Freaks. Libsyn.com.
And welcome back to Tokyo SOS. So to move on, we're going to move on from Special Effects. We're going to talk about acting. Let's talk about Matthew Broderick's performance. Jesse, you want to start us off with this?
Sure. I think he's really underrated actor in the first place, and I thought he really added a. He's kind of the everyman. He's not an action hero. So I thought his performance was good. Unfortunately, I don't like how he played off with the love interest, the chick. It was felt kind of forced, especially since it came so late in the film. But him, I really enjoyed on the whole.
Okay. Scott?
See, I like Matthew Broderick a lot. I agree. I think he's a very good actor. I think he's a very underrated actor. I think he does a good job in this movie, but conversely, I think he might also hurt the movie a little bit because I think he, to a certain degree, I think he overshadows Godzilla because he's Matthew Broderick. You know, I mean, he's so familiar to people in so many of his roles, especially Ferris Bueller, that I think that maybe that took people out of the movie a little bit or something, that they were seeing Matthew Broderick rather than a character, you know, this new character he was trying to play in this movie. But I don't think he's bad or anything. I just think maybe his presence was wrong, that maybe they should have gone for something else.
Well, I don't know about that, because I'll be honest, when I saw this movie, because it was 98, so I was at the oldest, 13, I think, when it came out. I had not seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off yet. I know. I was shocking that by that age I still hadn't seen it, but so I had to go back to look, but I think the only thing I maybe knew him from was Lion King.
Oh wow!
You didn't know that he was Simba?
Oh no, I knew he was in that. I'm thinking of all the other movies that he's been in, and that was the only one you knew him from. That's pretty wild.
He was in the 80s. He was in all those movies in the 80s when we were going to the movies all the time. You know,
yeah, but. Yep. I was born in 1985, so I didn't become conscious until 92.
Progress back to Lion King.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some Nala more, a little bit more there, Jess?
I'm good. I got my Nala speak out the way.
Chris?
Well, I thought Matthew Broderick was sort of just playing a variation on Ferris Bueller to an extent, like with his vocal cadence. And I honestly think that Roland Emmerich at some point told him when he was delivering his lines, he probably said, you know, you're a scientist and kind of nerdy. Can you make your voice a little higher pitched? Because it almost sounds like he's pitching up his voice a little bit.
Yeah.
And, especially and when he's doing Singing in the Rain.
Yes, yes. He's playing up the nerdy aspect. And there's a running gag that nobody can understand his...
last name?
His last name, and nobody can pronounce it.
Tatopoulos, Tatopoulos, Tikopis.
It's a running gag, yeah.
Which but, I guess means if he decided to go to Arizona, he'd be deported. But, hey, let's not talk about politics. I just kill the show there. But no, I love this performance. I thought it was great. With that, let's move on to Marie Pitello's performance. What did you guys think she did? Let's start with Scott this time.
I think she looked cute. I like that she's nipping in the very first scene that we see her in. But beyond that, she's the generic
nipping
ex-girlfriend that they end up hooking back up at the end of the movie. I mean, you could have got anybody to do that. So, you know, I neither like her nor dislike her. She's just kind of there, and she's kind of good to, you know, she's easy on the eyes.
I thought she played a great job of the New Yorker that's not lived in New Yorker or New York all her life, which I'm sure Chris can talk a lot more about. And we'll talk a little bit when we get to Hank and Care. But, yeah, I think she did that role perfectly, you know, especially with the whole gum in her mouth. That's sort of, I don't know why, but the gum in her mouth makes me think New York.
Everybody was chewing gum in it. They were all the quote unquote New Yorkers
were chewing gum.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Which brings the old joke of later when they're trying to sneak back into the city and Jean Reno's character gives them all gum. It's like, what's with the gum? It makes us look more American.
Right. Right. And you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it past Roland Emmerich to be like, I want these people to be super American because they're New York City, so we're putting gum in everybody's mouth. I could totally see it. And that's fine. I mean, as far as being like, I'm in New York State, but, you know, I'm a 10-hour drive from. Yeah.
You've been in New York City.
I've been there plenty of times, and I know a lot of people, you know, are displaced New Yorkers that I went to school with. And, you know, the people are pretty broad caricatures, you know, especially Hank Azaria. But.
Yeah.
There's a ring of truth to a lot of, you know, it does capture New Yorkness to the same extent that, say, you know, Spider-Man captures New Yorkness.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a filter because you got, you know, a German emigre directing it. But, you know, I mean, the characters are right. They have the right, you know, they're given the right attitude of, like, working class New York City, you know. I think the chewing gum part's a little ridiculous, but it worked. It was kind of funny, you know.
Jess?
I agree with Scott. I didn't really have any kind of a impact or any kind of opinion of her because she was just there. And I haven't seen her do anything else. So it's – I don't know. She was just kind of there. She was cute, but it's like she didn't really bring anything to the role. I liked Hank Azaria more.
Yeah, she was
yeah.
I'm just looking at her – trying to look at any – Natural Born
yeah,
Killer.
I looked her up on IMDb, and she really hadn't done much of anything since. Nothing of note.
And I don't know if it's – I don't think it's her. I think it's just the role they gave her.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I'm not disparaging the actress. I think she was good with what she was given. She just wasn't really given much.
Yeah. But with that being said, let's move on to point three in acting. Let's talk about the supporting actors, Jean Reno, Hank Azaria, Kevin Dunn, who – I put those three in because I thought those were the three best actors in the film entirely.
Yeah, I would add one more to that list. I would add Doug Savant, who played O'Neill.
Oh, yes.
Right. And he's since gone on. He's on that Desperate Housewives show now.
Yeah.
So he's gone on to a modicum of fame as well. So, but yeah, I think he's a really good character because, you know, he has the little, you know, personality quirk, you know, he stutters, he's very unsure of himself and all that. But by the end of the movie, he's gained his confidence and all. I like that.
Yeah.
I liked his character a lot.
But, you know,
Hank Azaria, I thought was excellent.
Hank Azaria, you know, if I had to say that was the best actor of the film.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, he's the funniest person in the whole movie, but the best actor in the whole movie, I think, is Jean Reno. I mean, that guy. He was the biggest star coming into this movie anyway.
He's great, but his problem was he doesn't
speak
very good English. And Well, it's not his problem, but it's like how you present him to American audiences. So, I mean, they got to make, you know, they made him French, and yeah, he's one. He's the best act, the best actor in this movie. He doesn't get have enough to really like. It's kind of wasted to have him in there because he's a leading. You know,
I thought he was really good.
He was good. He was good, but you know, man, I want to see him do more. He's just whereas Hank Azaria, I think his role is so perfectly suited to the movie, and you get to see him as a physical actor, whereas we're really used to him as a voice actor, and he's a great physical actor on top of being a voice actor. So the combination of the two made him the most interesting and engaging character.
But I think the point that made it perfect was when, you know, near the end of the movie where he's talking to Audrey and he's saying, well, let's go sneak out and follow them. I'm like, why don't we go out the front door? It's like, I can't let Lucy see me. She'll kill me. I'm like, yep, that's New York.
Yeah, and then when she sees him on TV, she's like, that's my husband. I'm going to
kill him.
Oh, she's hot, too.
Maybe it's just me. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's just... But no,
I think she's hot, but I think the nanny is hot too, so
I'm
Brian Rusher?
Oh,
she doesn't open her mouth.
I have to take a shower now.
You like what you like, you can't fight it. I
have to agree with Brian Rusher, just not, you know, when she talks.
Okay. Whatever. Yeah, but no, with John Reno, it's definitely a thing of my thing is that I feel that he's playing John Reno, which is, you know, he's been, to an extent, he's playing a character he's played before, and he does it very well, and I don't have a problem with it, but, again, as compared to Hank Azaria, who, for the most part, most people at that point only knew him for his voice on Simpsons. So, for him to play that part, to actually be seen, and to play that physical part he does, is awesome, you know, and just all the great one-liners, it's like, you know, he's like, whoa! And Audrey's like, what? This is where the Knicks shower and everything.
Yeah.
it's like such a New Yorker.
And then that's what somebody would say, for sure, yeah.
And then there's Kevin Dunn, who, I'll be honest, I've yet to see something that he's done that I've hated. I even liked him in Transformers. I thought he was great.
Who was he in Transformers?
He was the father. Yeah, he was the dad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, duh.
Ron Witwicky. Jess, you have any...
You remember more about that movie than I do.
Do you have anything on the supporting cast, Jess?
I agree that I think they were better than the main cast. Or they were more memorable. Because the two characters I remember are Jean Reno and Hank Azaria. It's like, when you ask me, it's like, yeah, obviously I remember Matthew Broderick.
But I think that's the point of a great cast, is when the supporting cast is just as memorable or more memorable than the main cast. Oh, he's a
personal. When I saw the scene, you know, obviously where Animal gets stepped on, you're like, what? Oh, man. And then it's like, oh, no, he didn't die.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, cool.
But that scene only worked because of his reaction.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have liked that. I would have hated that scene if you could feel his sense of exhilaration to be alive, disbelief of what had happened, and then he's starting to really actually put together in his head what just happened, and he turns around and just the look on his face, and like then the growing joy of being alive was just a very natural
reaction,
you know.
But with that, let's get to our last talking point, but I think we'll cover this real quick. Let's talk about the Simpsons connection, because you had three Nancy Cartwright, you had Harry Shearer, and you had Hank Azaria. So there definitely was
Harry Shearer is another great character actor. You know, great face, great voice.
I know he was great as Charles Kamen, who you absolutely hated, and the only thing I hated is that his character didn't get squished.
Yeah, you were sort of expecting it, huh? I was.
I wanted to see him wind up the same way that
I know. You're gonna
who's
say.
That super say annoying guy in the King Kong remake that gets squished?
Oh, no, you're not saying what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say the lawyer in Jurassic Park.
Oh, no, no. See, I am not a Jurassic Park fan. And that's one of the reasons I think I liked this movie so much, is that I felt like this movie was the payoff for the promise that Spielberg gave us in going into Jurassic Park, and then he totally reneged on, which is every interview I saw with Spielberg before Jurassic Park came out, he said that he wanted to basically do a big budget, big yep. screen remake of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And Jurassic Park, in yeah. my mind, does not remotely resemble The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. This movie yeah,
this movie a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so, Jurassic Park would be a park in the middle of a city.
In New York, yeah. Yeah,
and
exactly.
Something went wrong, and then you got dinosaurs running around a city, and then he half-wordly delivered it.
In Lost right. World.
Jurassic Park 2, yeah.
That, yeah, that's why I like that one so much better. You know, infinitely more than I like Jurassic Park, but then I like this one infinitely more than Lost World, because it's just, it's bigger, it's louder, there's more damage, there's more destruction, it's just completely over the top. Wait, and I don't go to see a big monster movie to not have it
for
be
subtlety.
Completely over. Yeah, it's got to be over the top. That's the whole point.
That's the whole point of monster movies, actually be monster
yeah.
movies.
Yeah.
And I think the thing with Jurassic Park is also the fact that, you know, with 1 and 3 being, and half of 2 being on an island, it felt more like a horror movie than
right.
it did a giant monster movie. Where this...
Right.
This is definitely a giant monster movie.
Right. In the Jurassic Park movies, you're fearing for the protagonists.
Yeah.
In a giant monster movie, you're fearing for a whole city, if yeah. not a continent. You know, you're not thinking of it on the people scale. Every once in a while, the protagonist might be in danger, but it's not about their survival. It's about getting the monster out of the city before he levels it.
See, I don't know. See, I approach giant monster movies a completely different way. I approach them that I'm rooting for the monster. I want to see the monster
yeah.
do as much damage as possible before he inevitably dies at the end of the movie. Because you know it's going to happen.
Well, that's
so
what you
why
really
not
want.
See him
that's...
take his... Yeah.
So let's move on from that. Let's get into story that only took us... an hour and a half to get into. Yeah, folks, we're just going to sit there here now. No,
that's how two freaks roll.
Yeah. we knew ahead of time that this may be a two-hour affair with Scott and Chris. So, the first thing we're going to talk about story-wise is we're going to talk about how this American Godzilla differs from the Japanese counterpart. And I think the biggest way I can talk... We talked about it a little bit in intelligence, but really... The Japanese Godzilla is a sort of tour de force. You know, it's a force of nature. It can't be stopped. No man-made weapon can stop it. You know, and it just does its thing and leaves. I'm trying to figure out a way to put it. It's more
like... creature.
It's yeah,
a
it's
giant
a creature.
Creature. It can be hurt. It can be
yeah.
bleed and be shot down. And
that's why I like the intelligence. You know, whereas, you know, yeah, we'd like to see a Godzilla that can't be hurt by weapons. At the same point in time, it is a thing of, because it's a creature and it can be hurt, and it's just nature doing nature's thing, it's a matter of, by giving it intelligence, and, you know, having it avoid gunfire, it sort of counterbalances the fact that it can't...
It needs that to survive, yeah.
Yeah.
It needs to be more intelligent to survive, since it's not impenetrable. And, yeah, and there was also a big subtext in the, not even barely subtext in the first original of, you know, there was a lot of the horror of, you know, the bombing of Japan in that movie, you know. It was a lot of, you know, it was like Invasion of the Body Snatchers being a reflection of our fear of communism in the 50s. This was, you know, a Japanese reaction to being nuclear bombed, and the concept of the nuclear bomb and nature not liking it, and nature strikes back. You know, there was, where in this one there's, you know, nuclear testing started Godzilla, but it's not really done as a moral. It's just done as a story propellant.
We'll get to that, because I actually have that as a similarity. But Scott?
Yeah.
Are you disagreeing with me, or?
No, I mean, was there a question here?
Yeah.
Yeah, comparing it to the original Godzilla.
See, I honestly don't know enough about the original to really draw comparisons beyond the fact that I like this version better.
Now, I think we're going to have to buy you the original Gorgia movie for you, Scott.
See, I just think that if this had been an unstoppable juggernaut, I know for me, I wouldn't like that as much.
Well, that's
I don't think
it would have worked.
Yeah.
In this case, but in the original, it worked.
Well, the whole movie's
all the best monster movies are exactly this same story. The monster comes in, whatever the monster is, and however it was created or whatever, it comes in, it does a ton of damage. Some clever scientist or somebody figures out how to take it down, and it dies at the end of the movie. All the best giant monster movies are exactly that very same formula. And I don't really want to see them vary that, other than maybe, you know, if you could figure out a way at the end that, you know, they knock it out and they put it in a cage, and then you're going to get, you know, Giant Monster Movie 2 next summer type of thing. That I could live with if they were made a successful series or something. But as far as them being, you know, giant and unstoppable, I don't see the appeal of that.
Well,
really, if you can't hurt it and you can't stop it, then where's the where's
King,
the
King
threat?
King Kong was sort of the yeah. Well, King Kong was sort of that's the King Kong model, sort of.
Right. Yeah.
With
King
less
Kong,
story, but Godzilla,
Adams, you know, it came from beneath the sea. They're all like that.
But I think Jesse was going to actually say something that was I was about to agree with. Jesse, do you want to talk about your point you were just about to say?
Yes, if you remind me of what that point was.
Yeah, I think you were talking about something about structure.
Oh, yeah, I was just saying that if this Godzilla movie was structured and that he was invulnerable, it wouldn't work because it is very much the old school Beast from 20,000 Phantoms, Reptilicus, that whole kind of movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't follow. It's not. That's why I don't really see it even as a remake of the original, because it doesn't even flow the same way.
Yeah,
it's like comparing two different like superhero movies. They all don't have the same plot.
Yeah, I mean it's a different plot from that perspective. Different plot. I mean, we're gonna talk about similarities in a second, but you know, really those are just sort of. I don't want to call them homages, but really I think maybe that's the closest word I can use to what the similarities are, because they do to an extent sort of follow, but again. In this case, it would be more like Godzilla King of the Monsters in its plot than it is the original Godzilla in plot.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Yeah.
So while we're there, let's talk about the similarities, you know, and again, you know, right off the bat, it is sort of a cautious tale against nuclear testing and nuclear waste and all that and sort of the thing it can do. Like the original and how nuclear bomb, you know, the one thing it isn't is in how the original was also a sort of a warning against war. This one, if anything, is more of a pro-war stance.
One's very militaristic and just, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the army is definitely your root, you know, I mean, when, you know, the army are portrayed as, you know, you're in the pilot seat when the helicopters are going around, you know, so you're, you know, identifying, you get to identify with some of the people that get their helicopters blown up, which isn't usually happening in.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Another similarity I was going to say is, and I know we've talked about this before, me and Jess. No, look at the main characters. You have military, you have a scientist, and you have a reporter. A la somebody faking to be a reporter, but a reporter nonetheless, and you have other reporters. So you have that similarity there. You have the similarity between Matthew Broderick's character and Dr. Yamano's character in the sense of how they really don't want to see the beast hurt. They want, they're caught between doing the thing that, you know, protects the city and makes the city safer by destroying it at the same time. They do want
discovering something new.
Yeah. And they want to study the creature there's also a connection between Audrey's character and the female lead and the original Godzilla, whose name is escaping me. So I'm sorry, folks, I can't remember.
Emiko?
Yeah, Emiko. Thank you. That memory.
Ooh, I remember something for once.
Yay! You moved up to second grade.
Screw you.
But no, Audrey and Emiko's character, in a sense that they're both sort of modern women in a changing time, where, you know, whereas Emiko, you know, it was a thing of sort of the political revolution and the thing that was going on in Japan at time, and, you know, how she was a modern woman still in sort of traditional Japanese times. Here you had a woman in Audrey who was a, you know, she was a modern woman trying to make it out for herself, and sort of the tough time that she had to deal with, and what is, you know, generally considered a male-oriented world in newscasting.
Yep, and you know, she gets her story stolen from her.
Yeah.
And then turns it into, you know, she steals it back at the end. She steals his thunder back at the end, which, you know, is going to happen. You know, that's just...
And you can sort of still say the same, and she also had sort of the same, well, not the same, but... Like, Emiko had a sort of a difficult, you know, choosing what to do in the sense of her love life with, you know, whether to go with her military boyfriend or go with Dr. Shizu, who I know I'm saying the name wrong. I apologize. Again, that whole memory thing.
Dr. Serizawa?
Serizawa, thank you. I should really know this, but... You know, she had sort of the same thing where she had to choose between her career or the person she loved. Really not a connection.
And she chose the career.
Yeah.
And also another similarity, Godzilla has dorsal fins.
Yes, yes.
Yep. I was very happy they started it out with a Japanese fishing trawler.
Yeah, that's one I forgot. I'm sorry.
And having, you know, the scene of the old man, the lone old man survivor, you know, uttering cryptic words. That was...
Well, in the original, it was a young man surviving who later then died later on when Godzilla invaded the island. And that's sort of another thing. Even though it was Panama, it still felt that sort of tropical island setting where they found Godzilla. You had the footprint... As the first level of finding out that this creature existed, just like the original. So,
yeah, I remember when I saw it in theaters, I was like, oh, cool, it's kind of following the exact story.
Yeah.
Course, yeah.
You know, shortly after that, it kind of veers off completely. But
yeah, because I don't remember three New England fishing trawlers in the original.
I love scene, though, where it drags all three of them under at the same time.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It shows you the power, you know, that
the power
this creature has to drag. I mean, because how strong would something have to be to drag three ships underwater?
Underwater, filled with air. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and you can see it on the faces of the people as they're going, the ships are getting dragged under.
Yeah. But something that wasn't that... Didn't talk about that first scene. Let's move on to the next point. Let's talk about the initial scene that Godzilla appears, which I think is considered a very iconic scene nowadays. I know Power Girl just parodied it in issue 4.
Now you're talking about where he comes up out of the sewer, the Matthew Broderick scene.
No, where he first appears in New York
on the dock.
Yeah, on the dock.
Yeah,
and when his fins come up.
Yeah.
I like that scene a lot.
I think that's one of the best scenes or sequences of scenes in the movie.
It could have been very cheesy. It could have been very stupid. But the special effects are done so well that it gives you the scale of Godzilla without showing, you know, how big he is. You're seeing how big he is, but you don't see what he looks like. And it's just a very nice, you know, I liked how he... revealed him a little bit at a time, you know.
Right.
He should have either done that or had him all at once, you know, no like sort of space, you know, not having him at the throughout most of the movie. I liked how he just sort of showed a little of him and within 5 minutes you'd seen all of Godzilla and then you could let him just go crazy.
And you know what, it kept the mystery going.
Yeah, that's one thing I think the movie did really well is the marketing as far as, you know, keeping the mystery, because nowadays if it would come out, like I guarantee you we'll all know what Godzilla looks like with the new movie.
Yeah.
Months before it comes out.
I don't know, they managed to keep the mystery on that thing in Cloverfield. hid pretty well.
Yeah, but that's because so
they did that all through the movie. That's why.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
you
know, for the sorry.
I was gonna say you never really see the monster in a movie either.
Huh?
You see him like at the very end.
Yeah, you get a pretty
good
shot.
It's a bird's eye view of him, of like up his butt, sort of. You know, he's just sort of stand. But yeah, it's always kept, which would make sense if you were running around with a video camera. You know, you really at that moment in time, you probably wouldn't concentrate too much on getting a good shot.
Which I'm sorry, I was upset with Cloverfield because that monster design disappointed me because you had J.J. Abrams saying, I want to create an American Godzilla. I'm like, oh, cool, awesome. And then we get that, like, screw you, J.J. Abrams.
I thought it was an enjoyable movie, but it pales next to the 1998 Godzilla as far as, you know, I mean, yeah.
That was a case of, like, the design being too
abstract.
Abstract, but still, like, following, like, a kind of, what's the word? Not safe, but just trying to be too realistic.
Yeah. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed all the aspects of it, and I liked how they tried to make it realistic, but it sort of took away the punch of that kind of movie. I remember going, that was an enjoyable movie, but I wasn't scared or excited during it, or I wasn't going, yeah, the Statue of Liberty head. You know, you're supposed to be more scared.
That movie was a lot more about the special effects and the things, you know, like the Statue of Liberty head than it was about the actual monster. And I think that's where that movie fails, as opposed to this movie where it's all about the monster.
And I can't believe I'm holding a Roland Emmerich movie up above a J.J. Abrams movie, but I am. by a decisive margin, you know.
Yeah. So, Scott?
Yeah?
You want to talk about that opening scene? Or add anything to what we're talking about?
No, I thought that scene was pretty cool. I like, I think it was Chris might have been the one that was telling me after he had seen the movie and I hadn't seen it, about how the ships kept dropping off of the creature as, you know, it comes ashore and it's walking through the city for the first time.
Yeah.
And all these ships and boats are constantly dropping off of it the whole time and smashing on the streets and on the highways. And so I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Because it gives you the sense of how big this thing really is, that as it came up out of the water at the dock, whatever boats were there just got hung up in its, you know, on all the stuff that was on its back. That's cool. I thought that was really neat. I like that.
Well, let's talk about a scene that a lot of people laugh at. That's the Madison Square Garden scene where we had all the baby Godzillas.
I agree. I would cut that totally out of the movie.
It's a good scene in that it works for like what it's supposed to be. It just doesn't belong in that movie.
It puts 20 minutes of a different movie into that movie where it should be.
I mean, you watch it and it's like, okay, what am I watching now? This isn't Godzilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's people closing a door with a dinosaur, baby dinosaur sticking its head in the door is not what I came to see at that point.
Yeah, and I think it hurts the movie a lot more than Godzilla not having atomic breath and not being indestructible does.
Uh-huh.
You know, because
sure.
And the thing about it is, I mean, it works for what it does. The whole point of those 20 minutes was why Godzilla is chasing the four characters around the city.
You could have done it in 3 minutes. You could have said, oh, look, he's laid eggs here. And, you know, I mean, realistically, those eggs, I mean, okay, whatever, it's a new type of creature, but come on, they just come out and they start looking for food, you know, and it's like, oh, they smell like fish. It's like, it shouldn't matter if you smell like fish. If you got warm blood in you, they should be, if they're hungry, they probably should eat you, you know, because they're cold-blooded, they'll eat whatever's, you know. But they could have just established Godzilla's laid eggs there, maybe had the eggs started to hatch, and then blew it up, and then they still had that in their pocket to
make Godzilla
set up a sequel. Yeah, right, so... But I didn't need to see them go through. It was just like going through the motions at that point because you knew that this was all really leading up to, you know, some real the Godzilla's
bang.
Not really dead Big Bang Godzilla end. So you're just waiting for this to resolve itself and play out its, and it plays itself out in a very predictable manner for that that, you know, a very Jurassic Park sort of manner. And it's like, all right, that's done. Now Godzilla can run and smash some more, you know. So it's,
yeah. And, well, you know, yeah. the thing, it's a matter of them trying to, you're explaining too much, you know. I mean, basically, right. You know, making it too scientific in the fact that, you know, these are basically marine iguanas that are mutated. And so they eat fish. Well, the reason they're chasing after them, they eat fish. I mean, it's an explanation. It works at the same time. It's sort of, again, by the book. So, Scott, yeah. Jess, do you guys have anything to add to it, to the message regarding?
No, I mean, that's pretty much exactly how I feel. It's like, even if I'm watching the movie, even when I watched it a few days ago, I was enjoying it, and then I literally got up to grab some pizza when that scene started. Just because
there's no tension, really, in it.
You know every beat that's gonna hit.
Yeah,
and does anyone really expect Godzilla to be dead at that point in the movie?
No, it was when you see how much movie there is left, and Godzilla is quote unquote dead. You know where it's going, and it's not like Roland Emmerich is going to try to be an unpredictable, twisty filmmaker. He's giving you a popcorn movie. So when you see that when I saw that stuff start to happen, it's like, oh, okay. This has got to play itself out before the story can progress anymore, because that's how this is going to be. And it didn't hurt that I was exhausted, and that by that point it was 2 a.m, you know. So it's just like, get to the smashy.
Yeah, see, movies like this, in my opinion, should be a good 90 minutes max. And this pads it out to the 2-hour mark. I don't hate it, but I don't feel like it really adds anything.
Jurassic Park 3,
either.
Lean and Mean.
I think what they should have done, if they were going to go with the whole egg thing and everything, rather than go into this very, I'll agree, very Jurassic Park territory, they should have gone for a more Aliens feel. I mean, if it already feels a little bit like Aliens anyway, with the whole, you know, room full of eggs scene.
Eggs. Yeah, you're
so
right.
So why not just go for broke? And if you're gonna, you know, borrow a little bit, then borrow all of it. Have Godzilla come back right at the moment where these humans have found the room full of eggs. And then you've got the Mexican standoff, just like in Aliens, you know, where the queen's looking at Ripley and Ripley's staring her down saying, you know, leave me alone or I'll toast your eggs kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you could get that whole egg subplot out of the way right there. And you don't have to have a whole bunch of baby Zillas running all over the place.
But then they wouldn't have another toy to sell.
Yeah, but I mean, you could still have that toy at the end of the movie, because the one scene I would leave in there, though, is I love the way the movie ends. I don't know if I should spoil it for those that haven't seen
it's been out for 12 years.
Yeah. I mean, I love that it ends with the scene that it ends with. So, I mean, there's your toy right there. You know, if you've got to have a baby Zilla, there
toys
it is.
Have been based on less screen time than that. That's for sure.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
The Freakmobile.
If
1995.
If any screen time at all, sometimes.
Yeah. But let's get on to our final point.
Yeah.
And I like that the animated series picked up where it left off with that scene. It's like, wow.
Oh, does it? I was just going to ask that. I've never seen that. I might actually have to track that down.
I might,
now and
too.
Yeah, you can catch it on YouTube.
It literally picks up right where that scene ends.
Yeah. And, you know, Matthew Rutterton, Dr. Nick, has actually I guess he has a research lab in the Bronx, or is it in New Jersey? It's like across the bay from New York. Eddie has and he has an assistant, and, you know, basically him and the other two scientists have been dropped because there's no more Godzilla, and they go to the research lab to try to track down more monster characters. Actually, what happens, they go searching for more eggs. He finds the egg. He sees the Zilla go off. He goes to try to track it. And when it finally comes back up a couple days later, it's grown to immense length or size. But the thing is, when it hatches, the first thing it meets is Nick. And so it...
It imprints on him.
Yeah, imprints on him. So it thinks Nick is his mother.
YouTube it.
Yeah, you can say. Let's talk about, again, talk about the final part. Let's talk about Godzilla's death. Now, what? There's one animal line that I forgot to mention that I really love, and that's in the tunnel, where they goes, "You're going to have to lure it out." It's like, "Oh, sure. Would you like it to wash it up and brush its teeth for you while we're at it?"
That's a good line.
Yeah. But, you know, I thought it was very creative that they get Godzilla trapped in the Brooklyn Bridge.
And,
and I think it's a nice touch that Godzilla gets destroyed by jet fighters, considering that in the original, the jet fighters showed up near the end of the movie, and we could never really tell if they had an effect or not, because, you know, he was already retreating. So for me, I thought it was certain, yeah, I could see that jet fighters would be the thing that could finally take it down.
I didn't like it.
I just thought, you can't feel as sad for a lizard as you can for a giant monkey dying at the end, so why have it die? But I understood that they wanted to try to do that. But honestly, I'd rather have Godzilla go and live in a volcano for a while and then come back.
Or
know,
a giant ice drift.
But it didn't really bother me that happened in the movie. I sort of figured that was sort of where it was going to go, that they would sort of go for a little bit of a King Kong. You know, I figured Roland Emmerich's not going to be subtle. He's going to, like, swipe a little bit from everything, you know, and just throw, I mean, Star Wars, King Kong, Godzilla, you know, whatever he wants, just throw, you know, Alien. That's fine, you know, but it wasn't one of the things that bothered me, but if I had written it, I wouldn't have had Godzilla.
I think
Godzilla
he tried
die.
To do it, but there was never that kind of character building between Godzilla and Nick.
You
as
can't,
much.
You,
so the impact wasn't there.
You just don't, people don't, I mean, when King Kong dies, you can anthropomorphize a giant ape easier than lizards are. You know, they're cold-blooded reptiles. They're just different, way different from us. So it's hard to feel for them as much, you know, or think of them as, you know, something with, like, complex emotions or whatever. Although, you know, they care for their youth and their children and all that. But,
I would imagine, though, that Scott liked it.
I thought it was pretty cool. I mean, I was torn because of all the monsters, Godzilla was the one I thought might get away at the end, because he typically does, doesn't he? At the end of his movies, he just kind of wanders off. And...
Well, in the original, he gets killed by the oxygen destroyer. In the second one, he gets buried in ice, which he stays in for like 15 years till Godzilla vs. King Kong. And Godzilla versus King Kong and Godzilla tumble into the sea, and it's King Kong who's seen swimming away. It's not really until Ghidorah the three-headed dragon that he starts to sort of survive, actually.
Oh, okay.
Well, even when he gets defeated, it's not a decisive defeat by humans. It was just kind of like he gets buried in ice. They just kind of hold him off. They don't really defeat him, short of the first movie.
Okay.
But I liked it, though. I thought it was very clever, you know, wrapping him up in the cables to where after a while, you know, being entangled and I guess the weight of the wires and the bridge and everything, you know, immobilized him to where they could finally shoot at him. I thought that was pretty clever.
It sort of made sense in a physical way, you know, when you saw it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I could see how that would happen.
Okay, so, yeah, I enjoyed it for what it was, so... overall, that's it. Let's quickly give our rating system. We give Godzilla Stomp. So we're going to start with our guest, Chris.
All right. How many Godzilla Stomps? What's the low and the high?
Five. You know, it's a five stomp.
The best.
Yeah.
It's Roland Emmerich. God, this hurts. This really, you guys just have to really appreciate. But I'll give it four stomps.
Ooh.
I will give it four stomps, as despite Roland Emmerich, despite the Jurassic Park sequence, I really enjoyed it. I'll watch it again, you know.
Okay, Scott.
I did just watch it again. I watched it this afternoon, as a matter of fact, and loved it all over again. So I'm gonna say, you know, trim out the Baby Zilla's stuff we were talking about. And, you know, this isn't just Godzilla. It's all giant monster movies lately, I think, have suffered from the same thing of they want to keep giving us these insipid stories of the people I really just want to see stepped on and munched. So stop trying to make me interested in these people. I don't care about them. I want them to die. So fix those flaws and it would be perfect. So I would say 4.5 out of 5, I would say.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Just out of curiosity, what are the outside of Cloverfield and the 98 Godzilla, what have been the other giant monster movies?
Jurassic Park, Lost World,
that came before
King Kong. You know, I mean, basically any giant monster movie, they all sort of suffer from this same thing of they want to tell me a story other than what I came there for, which is to see a giant monster eat stuff and destroy things. That's what I want to see. Stop trying to make me interested in Matthew Broderick's love life. I don't care.
Okay, Jesse?
I'll say three stomps, kind of average, just because the baby Godzilla scenes and some of the, like Scott was saying, the kind of pointless characters that don't live up to what they should be kind of balances out all the good stuff.
So, well, to give it a good average, I'm going to give it a four stomps. Give baby Zilla scene, and with some other things, but overall... You know, if you take it for what this movie is supposed to be, which is a popcorn flick, it's a very good movie. Yeah. So, now that we've completely destroyed me and Jesse's Godzilla cred by giving the 98 Godzilla a good review.
See, I think no one is expecting that.
Yeah.
Let the hate mail begin.
Well, let me ask you this, though, before we close out. What is it that everybody hates about this movie? Because I don't understand that at all. I really don't understand what it is people don't like about this movie. It's fun.
Scott said on our Facebook that we were doing this show, and someone said, I went and saw the movie, and I loved it. I didn't know it sucked till I went on the internet and read about it.
Right. Know?
Oh, I think for some people, some of the things is there are certain things about Godzilla that they feel Godzilla should have. One is the atomic breath, and the other is the indestructibility.
All right, you've said that I don't know how many times in this episode. Dude, he's got the atomic breath. He uses it twice in this movie.
No, but it's not atomic breath. It's power breath.
What's the difference? He shoots fire out of his mouth. What's the difference?
But he shoots gas that ignites a flame out of his mouth.
His breath, he shoots his... He breathes, and because of the heat of his breath, it ignited the gas tanks in the car, creating a fireball. But he never has.
Nitpicky. What does it matter if you fart and it smells like tacos, or if you fart and it smells like flowers? It's a fart, man.
Well,
he could aim the
atomic breath. He could shoot that in a beam and stuff. But yeah, okay, it didn't have that, but.
But yeah, I think for a lot of people, it's iconic.
We weren't one of those people.
I understand that, but it'd be kind of like Superman not having heat vision.
Right.
I mean, for a lot of people, it's iconic for Godzilla to have atomic breath.
I'd say the biggest distractors from the film that I heard were from Godzilla fans. Like, most of the people who just not liking the movie, like, you know, everyday Joes who go see it, are the same people who didn't like Independence Day and just don't like those films altogether.
Right. The story's weak, it's all bang and no depth and stuff like that.
Right.
Well, that's what those people don't understand about that kind of movie is, you know, that's why people are like, I don't understand why there were 500 million Friday the 13th movies, because people like to see what's in that. And if you give it to them exactly that way, they'll go see it.
And if I can, you know, just go into what I remember my mom saw it, and when she saw the movie, she says, how can I get into this? It's a giant iguana.
Right. So now picture that giant iguana shooting a laser beam out of its mouth, and imagine how much that ramps up that silliness factor that much more. And I think that's why they didn't do it. I think that the breath he has in that movie, I think, is a concession for hardcore Godzilla fans. They were like, how can we not do this?
We'll just do it sort of low key.
Yeah. So I think that they're doing it as they're trying to compromise. They're trying to meet the fans halfway.
Oh, I agree.
Those scenes were in there until fans pretty much said, hey, we made
a hullabaloo.
I mean,
I can view the film from two different perspectives as just a popcorn movie and then as a fan of the originals, but it's I recognize that it's its own film.
Yeah.
Right.
And we do. But, and you know, the thing is, I think today, a lot of the venom has left a lot of people. I mean, if we were talking 6-7 years ago, maybe some of that venom would still be there. Yeah. And I think that's what it came, is a lot of people, and again, I think I said before, a lot of people went into this expecting that they were going to get sort of the classic monster fighty-fight, and they didn't get it. So, but with that, so you have our ratings, you can kill us later. With that, we're going to do our usual thing of where we pin people. And, of course, Chris and Scott have many podcasts. So, Scott, you want to lay down all your guys' podcasts?
Well,
lay it down.
Well, our podcast that Chris and I do together is Two True Freaks. It's a weekly show. And we regularly, every single month, we cover Star Wars, Star Trek, comic books. And then on the fourth and sometimes even fifth weeks of the month, when there are fifth weeks, we have just kind of a who knows what we're going to do. Just a free-for-all show in which we'll cover most anything, you know, movies or commentaries or just any wacky thing that strikes our fancy. And then I myself on our same feed on twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. You'll also find a couple other shows that I co-host with Michael Bailey. There's Back to the Bins, in which Mike and I just bring random comic books, you know, randomly chosen comic books, back issues to the table and just discuss them just for fun. And, you know, just old back issues that we enjoy looking at. And then the other one that we do is Tales of the Justice Society of America, in which we're just discussing Justice Society stories, starting with All-Star Comics number 58 and moving forward in the timeline.
Hey, and I sometimes do a show called The Media Masochist, where I watch and experience horrible media of all kinds.
Which, by the way, Scott, do you realize two things happened tonight? One, I think this is the first show you've done in a long time that you've been immensely positive about.
Oh, now that's not true. Now I've been making much, much greater strides in my positivity.
Sure. And I don't think anybody's told you that John Byrne has sucked in 2 hours. So
okay, I'll give you that one.
So I think that's improvement for you. I think we need to give Scott a hand. Yay!
It's okay. You'll be seeing more John Byrne in our Comics Monthly Monday shows from now on.
And this that's true. And that's where Superman comes and throws you into the sun.
I am so glad that that has caught on.
Yes.
Of course, I have two podcasts. I have the Spectacular Webs podcast, which I do with my good friend Donna Mark. I have episode 9 recorded. And I'm probably going to get that out this weekend as of this recording, which I'm going to try to get out in 2 days. And we're actually going to be recording episode 10 next week as of this recording. And in about a week and a half, I'm also going to be with my good friend Lori Thompson, who does the No Apologies podcast. We're going to be a sort of a test episode for a brand new podcast that we hope to do about Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose. We don't have a name yet, but basically, if anybody out there is a fan of a comic book called Tarot, Witch of the Black Rose, which is written and drawn by Jim Ballant, we're going to be doing a test episode where it's going to be sort of the same thing. It's going to be a review sort of podcast, and we hope you guys check it out, because we feel that's a comic book that gets vastly underappreciated for what it is. Of course, we pimp our other friends on this show, too. So, of course, I want to pimp our good friend Kyle Yost, the other Godzilla podcaster in the world, with his KaijuCast, which you can find at www.kaijucast.com. He released an episode about 2 weeks ago in which he interviewed August Ragone, who is very famous for a blog he does, if I can remember. I think it's The Good and the Bad and the Godzilla, I think he does. They talk about Ultra Q. So, and really listen to it. It's a very good interview. And he also reviews Godzilla versus Megalon, I believe. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. He reviews Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to hurry up here. So, I do apologize if I got August's blog wrong. We, of course, as we said, Michael Bailey, who does Views from the Long Box, alongside with his other podcast that he does with Scott. Do check that out. He's finally getting new episodes out. The Spider-Man Crawl Space, which had its 100th episode, and wasn't for it to hear me kill the panel. Not like that, but with laughter. We have Batgirl to Oracle, a Batgirl podcast done by our good friend Stella Bowman. We have Amazing Spider-Man Classics, done by Donna Mark, John M. Wilson, and Bertone Beetle. Also, Bertone Beetle goes our good friend Zach Joyner, a.k.a. Spidey Dude, for the Clone Saga Chronicles. We have our good friends Gene and Chris, who do the Anime Shaft podcast, or Shaft podcast, as it's called. You have the Major Spoilers podcast, and it's other podcasts with them, Critical Hit. There's, of course, 2-2 Freaks. And I'm sorry, I'm stalling here, because I'm used to just talking about 2-2 Freaks, and Scott's already talked about them, so...
It's kind of redundant.
Yeah, it's kind of redundant. And, of course, our good friends over at the 2-in-1 Showcase. So check all those out. Jess, you want to tell people where they can find the show?
We're on iTunes. Just search Tokyo SOS. Also, please feel free to leave us some reviews. You can reach us at TokyoSOSPodcast@gmail.com if you want to shoot us an email. And we're also on Podomatic, TokyoSOS@podomatic.com. Okay. I believe that's everything, right?
Yep, I believe that's everything. Thank you, Scott, for coming on.
Oh, Facebook also, yeah.
Yeah, Facebook. You can find us on Facebook. Tell them, Jess.
Just search Tokyo SOS. And we're I think we're the only one up there that has that name, so pretty self-explanatory.
So, again, I want to thank Scott. Chris actually just had to go, so...
Hey, thank you for having us, man. I appreciate it. It's been a blast, and I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about something that I feel like doesn't get enough appreciation, and this movie is much maligned, so it was nice to get the opportunity to give it a little love and maybe portray some of the other side of the story, because like I say, I really dig it. So thank you very much for having us.
Okay. Hey, no problem, man. And it's awesome to have a different opinion other than Thomas's around, you know,
because I'm so horrible. Yeah. So that's it for this episode of the Tokyo SOS podcast. Until next time, Godzilla fans, run! Eat Godzilla!
Signing off from Tokyo, Japan.